Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. To commemorate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., we discuss Dr. King's life, his work, his legacy, and memory. We then explore the impact of Dr. King and his memory on contemporary issues, including the role of women on the movement and the security of people of color as embodied in the Black Lives Matter movement. What is the meaning of Dr. King's dream today? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This week, we celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King. We take time to consider the role he personally played in the civil rights movement, as well as explore the state of civil rights and Black activism in the United States and around the world. We will consider the memory of Dr. King and its impact on our understanding of the civil rights movement. We'll analyze the current state of civil rights movements and what Dr. King can teach us about their goals, tactics, and levels of success. And we'll examine the role of Dr. King's rhetoric and the value of the speeches that he's delivered in framing our understanding of what is civil rights and how do we achieve them. Our panel today is David Garrow. He's professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh and former senior research fellow at Cambridge University. And he's the author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which won the Pulitzer Prize for biography, among many other publications. Keith Miller is professor of English and affiliate faculty at the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Arizona State University. He's the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources. Jared Clements is postdoctoral research associate at Princeton University. He's the author of From Freedom Now to Black Lives Matter, Retrieving King and Randolph to Theorize Contemporary White Anti-Racism. And Dewey Clayton, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. He's the author of Black Lives Matter and the Civil Rights Movement, a comparative analysis of two social movements in the United States. Thank you all very much for joining us. David Garrow, we'll start with you. You've written this wonderful biography on Dr. King. So start off, give us a bit of a background. We kind of know the story of King, but what does the sort of common narrative sometimes get wrong or get a little bit mistaken?
The number one thing for people to understand about Dr. King was that he did not want to be in the public role that he ended up in. He was drafted by his Black community colleagues in Montgomery, Alabama, in December of 1955, to lead the new organization that was set up to support the spontaneous Montgomery bus boycott. And King felt, drafted, dragooned even into that role. He was relatively new in town, quite young, an independent figure, not tied up with some of the old rivalries within the Black Montgomery community. And he found being in the public spotlight very stressful. He had a sort of faith experience in early 1956, what the late James Cone and myself and others have called the vision in the kitchen of his parsonage, 309 South Jackson Street in Montgomery, where King felt this sort of crisis of confidence and understood God telling him that this was the role that was required of him, even if he didn't want it, didn't like it. And that deep ambivalence about being a celebrated figure continued right on through the entire balance of his life. It's one of the great ironies of all the FBI wiretapping of King, that one of the most powerful things we see from those wiretaps is King saying to his friends and advisors that he doesn't like all these honors, that he's getting too much credit. So the private King was a very self-effacing man, someone who didn't enjoy getting too much credit, didn't collect, his press clips, when he's named Time Man of the Year for 1963, he says something like, you know, what's one more award, you know, to one of his advisors. And so there's a fundamental humility to King, and he's deeply self-critical throughout all those years. He finds the role very stressful, increasingly stressful the better known he becomes. And with these awards, I mean, particularly when he receives the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, he feels that this excess of praise requires him to sacrifice himself even more. And so he has a very consciously self-sacrificial understanding of his role. When his popularity starts to drop, particularly 1967, when he attacks U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam, he has a very conscious awareness that he's harming his own reputation, but his need to say what he believes to be the truth, even if it's self-harming, always wins out for him. And so that self-sacrificial quality to King's life is, I think, the most important thing for people to grasp.
And Keith Miller, when we think of Dr. King, we think of, first and foremost, incredibly eloquent framing of issues. We think of, you know, his speeches and the words that he's delivered. How much should we view King as an orator, as somebody delivering these speeches? And how would you describe the sort of broad approach that he took to the speeches that he delivered?
Well, King's process of composing sermons is very interesting. He followed the practice of other well-established preachers, African-American and white, and he borrowed very liberally from other preachers' sermons, many of which were in print. And even the conclusion of I Have a Dream, he borrowed from his friend Archibald Carey from Chicago, who is an African-American minister. But he borrows sometimes the title of the sermon, sometimes the literary quotations, sometimes illustrations. Some of his literary quotations are used, as I document, are used in many books of sermons by many different preachers. So part of the reason he did that was to try to package his racial protest in a kind of a homiletic structure that the Northern liberal white audiences in the churches where he preached and at the church conventions and national church conventions where he preached, that they would find it acceptable because they're reading material that's familiar to them already. So he's not trying to be exactly original. He's trying to reach the audience and persuade the audience. So I document how he does this and also how the other preachers also did that, including the ones who were considered very scholarly, such as George Buttrick, who edited this massive multi-volume Interpreter's Bible that was kind of on the shelves of every liberal Protestant preacher in the country at the time. So somehow he managed to use this material, but to transmute it, and it sounds more eloquent and more magnificent when he's using it than when other people did. And one thing interesting is that if you look at the scholarship on Shakespeare, Shakespeare composed in a somewhat analogous sort of a fashion. He uses all kinds of motifs from these earlier writers, Ovid and Seneca from classical Greece, and Boccaccio and Chaucer and lots of different writers. He uses them in all kinds of ways, and he always makes them sound better than how they started to sound. So the composing process is very interesting, and I think that people need to appreciate King in the context of lots of other people. He also drew very heavily, as Gary Dorian explains in a recent book, from an African-American social gospel tradition of Benjamin Mays, Mordecai Johnson, Howard Thurman. And in some ways, his father was part of that tradition. His father was a close friend of Benjamin Mays. So I think that all that is important.
And so we're getting a good picture of who King was, you know, as a person, as an orator, et cetera. I want to delve into some of the memory of King as well. I mean, he's both an individual, real person, but also as a reminder for the commemoration of his birthday, he's a symbol. He's a the symbol of civil rights and the symbol of activism. And so Dewey Clayton, I want to bring you in. I know you've written about sort of the comparisons of civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter. I guess to first delve into this is, how much does King define the civil rights movement? How much, when we think of civil rights, we should think of the person of King? Or is that kind of simplifying or kind of flattening what the civil rights movement is?
Well, I don't know. It depends. I would say, personally, I think that many people classify the civil rights movement as basically being King. And he clearly was a part of it, and he became largely a face of the civil rights movement. But it's wrong to basically center it with King. There were many people. Civil rights has been going on in this country for a long time, and King certainly becomes the face of the civil rights movement. But one has to remember, he happened to be the right person at the right time. There had been civil rights movements going on prior to World War II. In particular, you had the NAACP being founded in 1909. You had many other organizations coming along. You had the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters with A. Philip Randolph. You had many others. And it seemed as some of that activism was put on hold, particularly during World War II. Coming out of World War II, I think there was a renewed emphasis. And Brown versus Board of Education, in particular in 1954, sort of opened the door for this new type of activism. And as I said, King happened to be the right man at the right place. 1955, he finds himself in Montgomery wanting to establish his own church. He's 26 years old, and things just sort of move in that direction. And so he becomes the face of the civil rights movement to a certain extent, but one must realize that there were many other people involved as well. King just happened to sort of be the face of the movement. He was eloquent. The press became very enamored with him from the beginning. And so that helped greatly. But to just sort of limit it to King, that I think that would be a real disservice.
No, absolutely. And Jared Clevens, I want to bring you in now as well, because King's words and the imagery that King, you know, has presented has been used by so many different political actors across the political spectrum. How much is King, is the legacy of King, the language of King, et cetera, framing civil rights questions, particularly in contemporary America?
So the first thing I would say, and what I would suggest to everyone, your listeners, is that so much of King's writings and his speeches are easily accessible. So I think it's really good to go to the source and see for yourself exactly what he had to say about a number of issues. And it's also important to realize that King was a voracious reader, and he changed his views on things as his as he aged. And so if we look at King in, let's say, 1959, that's going to be a much different King than the King we see in 1967. And so because of that, it's easy to extract a quote from one year and then try to, you know, apply it to another era. But it's really important to think about the totality of what King was about. And I would say that from there, we can see that one thing that, kind of building upon David's point, one thing that struck me about King in reading his speeches, his written works, and so forth, is he had an immense amount of compassion. So for King, like, it wasn't, although obviously he wanted to improve the plight of Black people in America, for him, there was a human aspect to the way that he operated. And so I think it's just really important to not try to parse, like, specific sayings and try to apply that to contemporary times without thinking about, like, the broader context in which he was speaking. And I think because King is such a colorful speaker, and because he does have these kind of sweeping orations, it's really easy to, like, slice and dice these quotes and plop them on a Facebook message board or something without really thinking or reckoning with some of the deeper meanings of what he was about. And so In my own work, I try to think about both the context in which King was writing, because I think that's important, but also thinking about what he was saying then, or in 1960 or 63 or 67 or whatever, can be applied to perhaps some of my more contemporary understandings of racial justice today. So,
and you're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the person, the legacy, the impact of Dr. Martin Luther King on the civil rights movement, both in the 60s and in contemporary times. And our panel today is David Garrow of the University of Pittsburgh, Keith Miller of Arizona State University, Jared Clemens of Princeton University, and Dewey Clayton of the University of Louisville. David Garrow, one thing I really want to kind of drill down on a bit here is the importance of spirituality, of, you know, of religion. We have this image in contemporary politics of, you know, if you're Christian, you stand on one side of the ideological spectrum. And if Christianity isn't really driving your ideology, you stand on the other side. But Dr. King was first and foremost a Christian minister. And
exactly.
What's the role of spirituality?
King's whole upbringing was in the world of the Black church, and Keith can speak to this at least as well as I can. We have a new major forthcoming biography of King coming in May from my friend Jonathan Eig. And John's great achievement in this book is to really open up the first two decades of King's life. How deeply grounded he and his family were in Black Atlanta, in the churches of Black Atlanta. And Dr. King should be thought of as first and foremost a product of the Black Baptist preaching tradition. I mean, Keith has written on this. My late friend Jim Cohn, very importantly, influentially wrote on that. And just to build on something Jared said a few moments ago, by far the best King sources for people are his sermons, and particularly the sermons at Ebenezer once he moves back to Atlanta in 1960. There's a power and there's an intimacy to his sermons at Ebenezer that we don't see in most of his other orations. Because when he's preaching at Ebenezer, virtually everyone in that congregation has known him since he was a toddler. And to call it his home church is almost an understatement. Now, unfortunately, listening to those Ebenezer sermons on the web is a real challenge. The King Papers Project is sort of stuck in 1962 for a number of years. And in all frankness, I would warn people away from King's published books because they were composed by committee. Some of it's, you know, Andy Young, some of it's Bayard Rustin. Why We Can't Wait is primarily a ghostwriter named Al Duckett, who also wrote a book for Jackie Robinson. A lot of King's magazine articles similarly were the product of committee work. Now, that's not at all unusual for any public figure. But when King was preaching, almost always, he's not reading from any text. Again, Keith can speak to this better than I can. You know, he may go up there with an outline, but many of these sermons he'd given a dozen times before, and pieces move around, new stories appear, but you'll be more emotionally moved by the sermons, more so than when he's talking to a civil rights rally.
Keith Miller, I'll bring you in and get your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I agree with everything that David just said. I would like to, if it's okay, I'd like to go back to the question that you asked Dr. Clayton about the memory of King.
Absolutely.
To me, there's basically four civil rights movements. The first one is what actually happened. The second one is what the reporters reported at the time. And the reporters were almost entirely male. So they assumed leaders were men. So they followed the men around, especially King, but also Medgar Evers. And the third one is what the historians have done. So the historians in the last 20, 30 years have widened the lens. So that's why we haven't had a major biography of King in a very long time. The historians have been working on biographies of these important national, state, and local leaders, many of whom are women who are overlooked by reporters. So there are biographies of Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Pauli Murray, and so forth. So the historians have widened the lens from what the reporters have done, but this might be arguable, but to me, the national memory, the public memory has shrunk, even, and it's even more King-centered than it was according to the reporters. And I think President Obama is partly responsible for that, because when he talks about the movement, he almost always talks about King. He usually talks about I Have a Dream and Selma. So there's a contrast between the historians trying to widen the lens and the national memory is more King-centered, even though King was not involved in some of the important parts of the civil rights movement, such as the Little Rock Nine in 1957, such as James Meredith at Ole Miss in 1962. They were all big headline news stories and built momentum that, you know, eventually culminated into major legislation in 1964, 1965, and 1968. So I think that that's a discrepancy that people need to look at. And I think a lot of these women are very important. And also there's local male leaders like Fred Shuttlesworth who've gotten their biographies. So anyway, I just want to say that. I think it's useful to think of that there are four movements.
And Jared Clemens, I'll bring you in, get your thoughts as well.
Yeah, so to Keith's point, and so one thing that I wanted to do in the paper that Doug mentioned when I was introduced was really try to offer a bit more historical context in which some of these popular speech quotes were taken from. So I think often about like the quote about the white moderate that you see just repeatedly thrown out in kind of in public discourse. And people take that as a way to, I guess, sow suspicion or question the intentions of individuals in a way that I don't necessarily think is, I don't think it comports with what King himself trying to, I think part of his compassion stemmed from wanting to build more solidarity, both across interracially, across class collaboration as well. And I think that the way that some of the quotes are kind of, again, taken out of context, really do us a disservice for really trying to understand kind of the context in which King was operating and kind of some of the engagements that he was partaking in. And so I just think it's really hard in our current culture because we do have this kind of Superman way of thinking about politics. It's that, you know, these big political events are kind of the result of one great person who just kind of essentially is dropped from the sky and then saves the day, essentially. But as everyone's kind of mentioned, that's just generally that's not the way that politics or any type of social activity works. And so I do think that I wish there were a way, as somebody, I guess, who is a millennial, and I think about the way that our media ecosystem is structured, like TikTok is much more amenable to this kind of quote that's divorced from any type of like social or political context as a way to generate impressions and to get people, I guess, interested in these figures, but without doing the work of actually thinking about the history and the nuances of whatever of whatever particular time that they're derived from. So I just wanted to add that.
And Dewey Clayton, I think one of the challenges then is King is elevated to this heroic status. And then after he's killed, who's going to step into those hero shoes? And so what's the impact of the civil rights movement when you elevate King to this almost superhuman status compared to a lot of people who we might even call them the foot soldiers, but the people who are out there doing a lot of the heavy lifting themselves?
Well, I think you raise a good point because I wanted to go back, if I could, for just a second. In fact, it really is right in line with what you actually have talked about. You know, King gets credit for a lot that happened, but the civil rights movement became a movement because of ordinary people all across this country, particularly in the South. And these are the people who put their lives on the line every day. And, you know, they were responsible for organizing, mobilizing. King would come in and do a lot of work and help with that. But as I said, these were ordinary people. And also, I'd like to add, young people infused a lot of energy and excitement in the movement. Even when the movement was on the wane to a large extent in the late 1950s, it was young people that sort of picked up the mantle and carried it forward. They had the enthusiasm, they had the idealism to want to make a difference in this country. And this was Black and white young people, I'd like to say as well. These were college kids all around the country. You had white women at Vassar, mobilizing and organizing and sitting in and lunch counters. So it was an excitement that sort of spread. And King gets credit for a lot, but a lot of times King would sort of, pop in place somewhere. And sometimes he actually was wanted, and other times some of the local people actually were not really pleased with that, because the media would follow King wherever he went. And then when the media would leave, when King would leave, I should say, the media would leave as well. And that would make it difficult for many of those people to continue doing what they were doing. But I think it's a real mistake just to sort of pin everything on, with King. Certainly he was a good voice and he had a great message. And that message was actually a new message to a large extent, because King spoke with a new voice and a new message. And that message was one of nonviolence. There were African Americans throughout this country who were pressing for justice and social justice and rights, but many of them were not necessarily involved with the civil rights movement, because they weren't necessarily in favor of the tactics, those being nonviolence. They were not happy with what was going on. But that was something, I think that is one important addition that King added to this. He thought that the way that you would gain supporters and financial backers was, like I said, it was nonviolent civil disobedience. And certainly King borrowed that from the writings and teachings of Jesus, but also from Gandhi as well. And so I think that helped make a huge difference equally.
When we come back, what is the impact of Martin Luther King's ideas, ideology, commitment to nonviolence? And what do they mean for contemporary politics? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We are commemorating Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday and the Civil Rights Movement. We explore his legacy, the impact of his messages on contemporary civil rights issues, and the appropriation of Dr. King by political actors across the ideological spectrum. What does it mean in a contemporary political arena where civil rights are still contested? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is David Garrow, professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh and a former senior research fellow at Cambridge University. Keith Miller, professor of English and affiliate faculty at the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Arizona State University. Jared Clemens, postdoctoral research associate at Princeton University. And Dewey Clayton, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. David Garrow, I guess I'll start with you. This is going to be a question sort of for everyone. Right now, particularly this weekend, with the legacy of King, political actors from all across the political spectrum are going to cite King, and often as a way to try to discredit contemporary civil rights movement. Cite King's speech, "I have a dream that we're going to have a race-free, a race-blind society," and then declaring, "Well, then why are we so focused on race in contemporary politics?" First of all,
What does King have to say about contemporary politics and race relations today?
Yeah, we're coming up on 55 years, you know, since Dr. King's death. You know, I've been doing this, you know, 44 years now, a little more than that, going back to my first book on Selma and the Voting Rights Act. And I must say, as the years go by, the efforts of people to apply Dr. King to the present day get more and more strained. You know, we can't really say what Dr. King would have thought about critical race theory because Derrick Bell and Kim Crenshaw didn't start writing that material until, you know, long after Dr. King was gone. And similarly, in the international context, I mean, so much of what King invested himself in the last 2 years of his life was opposing the military conflict in Southeast Asia. But how we take the Vietnam War and apply that to anything today, you know, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, the line that Dr. King used April 467 at Riverside Church about the U.S. government, well, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is without question Vladimir Putin, you know, who's running a mafia dictatorship. You know, I rigorously sort of discipline or censor myself on the, you know, what would Dr. King say about X, say about Y, because it's at best an informed guess, and we're better off to stay within the strictures of what King himself was preaching in the 50s and 60s.
But also, Dewey Clayton, I'll ask this of you, but kind of throw it out there as well. One thing that I feel pretty confident that King would have something to say, and we could probably imagine, has been the gutting of the Voters' Rights Act. And so in many ways, when you think about the civil rights movement, there's this sense frequently in the media that there was an end to it, that we civil rights movement was a 60s thing, maybe a 70s thing. But even the accomplishments in the 60s are now coming under fire. What does that say when thinking about King's legacy, that some of the greatest accomplishments of the civil rights movement are still under attack?
Well, that's true. And I think that I think King would be aware of that. I think as a student of history, I think King was very well aware that throughout this nation, particularly in the 20th century, it seemed like every time there was a civil rights push, degree of activism and change was made, there tended to be a backlash from white America. And that happened at the end of the civil rights movement. It's happened at the end of the Black Lives Matter movement as well. And so I think King would clearly be saddened by a lot that's happening now, but not be totally surprised, would not be totally shocked that one of his lieutenants, John Lewis, you know, who fought so valiantly along with so many others to, you know, get the Civil Rights Act, I'm sorry, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed and what that involved, and to see how Congress has responded to that and to see how the Supreme Court has responded to that and essentially gutted two major sections of it, Section 5 and Section 2 as well, I think he would be sad and clearly, but I think that he would not be totally shocked by what has happened. I think he was astute enough and smart enough to realize that, you know, America, although we, his I Have a Dream speech in particular, you know, that was an ideal, and King knew that we would not be reaching that ideal anytime soon. So yes, I think he'd be shocked, but I don't think he'd be totally appalled at what is some of the legislation and some of the attitudes that have crept back into the American mainstream.
Jared Clemens, I know you've written about white anti-racism, and that phrase itself has numerous contexts when I read this, because at one level you get this kind of a white anti-racism that Dewey Clayton says, well, this was an ideal, this was a dream, but frequently the argument is we've achieved that, or if we're going to achieve it, we have to implement that. So the I Have a Dream speech is being almost anti-civil rights these days. How much of that is white anti-racism framed by a white audience as anti-racism versus allyship with respect to white anti-racism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's one book that I want to flag just because I think it's a really great text. And I think both people in your audience and just more broadly would appreciate it. It's called Prophet of Discontent by Jared Loggins and Andrew Douglas, both political theorists who make this argument that in the book that one thing that often happens with the way that we think about or remember King is we tend to downplay the extent to which King was very much attuned to questions of political economy and the material foundations of racial justice. And so King, they make the case that he understood that, you know, having access to the vote, you know, the voting booth, the ballot, or other civil rights, while important, ultimately that wasn't enough to ensure the type of equality that was necessary. And in other words, like there needed to actually be some reckoning with the way in which we have organized a society where there's such vast amounts of inequality and wealth accumulation is happening in a way that's not at all equitable. And so I think King would understand that, you know, part of what America, you know, what we have, one thing we have to reckon with America is just the vast amount of poverty and social inequality that continues to exist. And the attack on voting rights is just yet one another way to ultimately disempower people through the electoral realm. And so I think King would, of course, not be surprised by what's going on. But if I had to guess, of course, obviously, none of us are, you can be interlocutors at this point. So it's just a guess. But I do think that he would really beg us to think bigger about what the American project is, and you know, how not only how do Black people sit within that broader project, but how we can look at the condition of many Black Americans as really this kind of harbinger of like kind of broader systemic changes that need to be reckoned with. And so, I don't think he would be at all shocked by what's going on, but I think there's ways that we can kind of look at some of the things that he said about political economy and inequality and glean some things from that.
And Keith Miller, you kind of also reminded us that the civil rights movement has an intersectionality that historians seem to be discovering a bit more over the course of the last, you know, 5-10 years. And I would, as somebody who is himself a memory scholar, would imagine that the main reason for this has been the rise of political power, the rise of the Black women as a part of the civil rights movement. And so I guess the question then is, you know, that linkage, that it's not just a question of race, but an intersectionality question where you introduce gender and class as a part of this as well, as a contemporary political issue. So I guess, how much is this restructuring and this readjustment really about recognizing women played a big role in the civil rights movement, and we need to recover that memory because this is still so very much a contemporary issue about women's rights?
One really interesting part of the civil rights movement, Doug, that most people don't understand, I think, is that there were women in the civil rights movement, such as Polly Murray and Anna Hedgman and Mary King and Casey Hayden, who thought that the civil rights movement was or should be about women's equality and gender equality as much as it was about racial equality. And you really see that with Polly Murray. And they also, Polly Murray, Dorothy Height, they were active long before Rosa Parks, and they were active long after Rosa Parks, long after King's assassination. So their whole idea of the civil rights movement is very different than the national memory, because it's not only about the triple evil, what King called the triple evils, poverty, racism, and more, but it's also about gender equality. So there were people at the time who were arguing for that, and Polly Murray and Anna Hedgman were trying to get a woman as a speaker at the March on Washington, and they got turned down by King and A. Philip Randolph. They said, no, we don't need you. We don't need you. Just go off in the background. And so the idea that the civil rights movement is only about race is contested by people who are involved in the civil rights movement and who are important leaders in the civil rights movement, such as Pauli Murray, who was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt and who later mentored Ruth Bader Ginsburg and had a very long career. And in the 1970s, she was ordained as one of the first female priests in the Episcopal Church. She was a very important pioneer, and she didn't get a biography until about 2015, 2017, something like that, by Rosenberg. So there was this tension going on in the movement, at least, you know, behind the scenes.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the legacy, the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King and the state of the civil rights movement today with our panel, David Garrow of the University of Pittsburgh, Keith Miller of Arizona State University, Jared Clemens of Princeton University, and Dewey Clayton of the University of Louisville. So the last big topic I want to take on is when we think of civil rights today, Dewey Clayton, and you've written about this specifically, we think of Black Lives Matter. And frequently, because Dr. King had advocated for nonviolence, and the argument that Black Lives Matter is not as committed to nonviolence, that in some ways that Black Lives Matter doesn't rise up to the image that we have of the civil rights movement. Is there a tension between the tactics of Black Lives Matter, the emphasis of Black Lives Matter, and the civil rights movement under Dr. King?
I don't know if I'd call it tension. I think that looking back and looking at the civil rights movement and looking at Black Lives Matter, it's difficult, in my opinion, to compare the two. Times are different. Times have changed suddenly. If you look at the civil rights movement, there was no social media going on then. There's clearly social media going on now. And even in looking at that, if you look back during the civil rights movement, a lot of what the young people were doing, even some of the things that Dr. King was doing, you know, his father was not in favor of. So when you get a younger generation, you always get, you know, the older generation saying, you know, behave yourself. Now, I will say this. I will say that that the civil rights movement prided itself on respectability politics. And it was about dressing nice and acting nice when they sat in and lunch counters and whatnot. They were well-behaved. They were calm. They were respectful. Black Lives Matter does not necessarily follow that tack. But once again, they're young people. It's a different time. And so one would not expect them to actually be in the same mode. But I will say that they've got a lot of the same goals. And I don't think Black Lives Matter is as violent as a lot of people possibly think that they are. I really don't. I mean, there have been instances throughout various marches and whatnot where there was some violence that occurred, but that occurred back during the civil rights movement. King was often, and others were often, trying to tamp down, you know, some of the violence that was occurring. So I think I don't think that's necessarily the case here. I see them as basically in a long line of social activism, and I think that basically what they're doing is the same type of enthusiasm and willingness to sort of take things one more step. They're much more confrontational than the civil rights movement had been, but so what? That's good too, you know, and they're achieving many of the goals that they've done. They've brought the issue of social justice, and particularly police brutality as it relates to, you know, African Americans. They've brought that to the forefront. And look at the results we've gotten. Look, in 2020, we had hundreds of thousands of people, even more than that, protesting all around the world. So I think that's a bad rap in many respects, and I don't really fault them. It's a different movement. It's a newer movement, and obviously some of their tactics, some of their methods are going to be different, but I think they have achieved great results with what they've done, and they've brought this attention to the forefront of people, not just in this country, but all over the world.
And Jerry Clemens, your thoughts as well.
So I think the first thing I'd say is I think there's a way that we tend to reify the Black Lives Matter movement as though there is like this singular kind of kind of organization that's all everyone's kind of pulling in the same direction. And I think that does us a bit of a disservice, one, because very few movements ever operate that way. There's always going to be discord and differences as to how people understand whatever the ultimate aim is of the movement. And so I think one thing that we should reckon with or think about in Black Lives Matter is, again, these different strands of Black Lives Matter. And I think in doing that, you can see that there are some very real radical strands of Black Lives Matter, which are, let's say, anti-capitalist, very much about making sure that it's an intersectional approach to thinking about a movement building. And then there are some that are perhaps a little bit more amenable to the status quo. And I think underscoring that is important. Because then you can see a little bit more, I think, some of the pressure points that I think have become a little bit apparent within the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I would say that also, I think that the distinguishing between what Jane McAvey calls organizing and mobilizing, I think is also important just for thinking about political change. And so she makes the case that what we saw in 2020 was, in many respects, more of mobilizing. So you're getting people to feel some kind of emotional or this kind of groundswell of emotion in response to an event, whereas organizing is more of the mundane calling people, following up. It's all in those things to really build towards, you know, a handful of political demands that can be realized. Now, to the point that was made just before, I do think that there are some very real differences now in organizing. We live in a much more, ironically, we're much more connected than we've ever been in so far as like technology is concerned. But I think there's abundant research that shows, but we're also much more alienated and feel isolated and disconnected from one another in ways that we kind of haven't before. So there's this kind of contradiction there that I think we have to really think about. And so bringing this back to King, I think one thing that we could all stand to do a little bit more if we are committed to some of the ideals that he espoused is to really try to have that compassion for other people, irrespective of their racial status or their gender background, and just really think about, you know, how could we build a more inclusive world. So I think that there's a lot that the Black Lives Matter movement can offer us, but there are also some things that we can think about and critique and evaluate going forward as well.
Jared, when you're thinking about this, we focused on social media as a potential variable and the kind of a democratization component of that. I wonder as well, especially since you highlighted some of the anti-capitalist sentiment, at least with some aspects of Black Lives Matter and civil rights, the impact of the Occupy movement, and that the Occupy movement has had an influence on civil rights that we sometimes don't recognize.
Yeah, I think that's important to also think about the ways in which movements often overlap. So we can't really think about the civil rights movement without also thinking about the ways in which it overlapped with the labor movement. Like, these things don't just operate in a vacuum. And oftentimes people who were affiliated with one were also affiliated with the other. And so I do think it's important, again, thinking about solidarity and, you know, where are the areas that we can find common ground and agitate towards similar ends. Of course, we're not going to agree in everything, and everyone's going to bring to bear their own, you know, normative understandings of the world that sometimes can be hard to reconcile, but oftentimes there are those areas of similarity. And so I do think it's important to think about other movements, or even thinking about the Sunrise movement. And so is there a way that we could connect climate change to racial justice? I think there are a number of people who are doing great work that show the racial inequalities that stem from the climate crisis. So I think that there are a number of movements out there that are ripe for this type of cross-pollination, sorry.
David Garrow, when we're describing this, when we look at Black Lives Matter and the frustration sometimes the media has and critics have with a lack of leadership, there's not a Dr. King within the Black Lives Matter movement. Is this always a sort of a historian's, you know, false equivalency, that if you associate civil rights movement with Dr. King, if there's no Dr. King, then where's the movement?
There's a long-standing media problem. I mean, going back before Dr. King, of journalists wanting to find a singular Black leader. you know, the greatest change in the U.S., you know, racially the last 50 years is what a, you know, huge increase in the number of Black elected officials there's been. And you look at the Congress today, there is a degree of diversity among Black members of Congress that's not widely or nationally discussed enough. John James of Michigan, for example, new member of the House of Representatives, highly impressive conservative Republican, someone we're going to be hearing from down the road. And don't forget, you know, the most influential Black person in America today is Clarence Thomas, widely misunderstood because folks should read what Thomas himself writes, not what people write about Thomas. Sort of the same principle we advocate with regard to Dr. King. Read King, you know, listen to King. But there is a diversity now in Black America. And with Black Lives Matter, so much as was touched upon earlier, you know, varies, you know, city by city, locale by locale, just as with the Black freedom struggle during the 60s. So I think it's important not to follow the media tendency to want to simplify and force a very diverse world into just one silo.
Keith Miller, now that we're up upon this commemoration, we've just got a few minutes left. And what should be our takeaway of the civil rights movement as we remember Dr. King? What should we remember?
Well, to get back to the discussion of Black Lives Matter, to me, the country has shifted a lot because during the 1950s and 1960s, America was largely culturally Judeo-Christian. So the Southern Civil Rights Movement operated on out of a Judeo-Christian framework, and certainly King did, Fannie Lou Hamer and James Lawson, Fred Shuttlesworth. And today, America, the religions in America are much more diverse. So we have so many Muslims in the country and Hindus and Buddhists, and so many progressives now regard themselves as, quote, spiritual but not religious, or as atheists. So it's much harder to use the Judeo-Christian framework. William Barber is doing that, and he's operating very much in the tradition of the African-American social gospel and King. But it's not just a problem of young people or social media. It's a problem of what kind of premises do you use to make your arguments with a such a diverse population. And I like the work of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan, who have a secular analysis, a political science analysis, and you're a political scientist, Doug, that tries to figure out which strategies in nonviolent movements work under what circumstances and what countries and which ones don't work. When do you need a boycott? When do you need civil disobedience? And I think that that's refreshing because we're so accustomed to thinking about nonviolence in the context of religion. Gandhi is a Hindu, Cesar Chavez is a Catholic, and so forth. But sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. So I think that using a political science kind of analysis can be very useful and helpful.
I'm so glad you mentioned that work. I teach a course in peace and conflict. I always assign, actually complete, you know, finish the class with that as a way to think about peaceful change. And with that in mind, we've got about 2 minutes left. Dewey Clayton, I'm going to give you the chance for the last word here about what ultimately, when considering the role of King, considering the role of civil rights in America today, what should be our takeaway this year as we think about Dr. King and civil rights?
Well, you know, I think King inspired the nation, he inspired the world. You know, throughout this country, as we speak, there are probably young children in China who are reading about King and studying about King's. So I think, I said earlier that it was an ideal, but I think that he gives us something to always sort of strive for. Conservatives, liberals, you name it, everyone quotes King. Everyone talks about King. Now, they don't necessarily get it right when they talk about King. And a lot of people are talking about King, and I don't know where they're coming from. But I just think he is a constant source of inspiration for the world as such. If I can go back real quickly, I'd like to make one point. We were talking about the Civil Rights Movement and then Black Lives Matter. We were also talking about how women did not get their due in the Civil Rights Movement. And if you look at Black Lives Matter, they were created by Black women. So if you look at the two and make some comparisons, as you had stated, the Civil Rights Movement was clearly a top-down, traditional form of leadership. Black Lives Matter never wanted to be that. They wanted to be decentralized from the beginning. But getting back to King, like I said, I just think he will be an endless source of inspiration and an endless goal for all of us to strive to attain.
No, absolutely. And we have at least four great sources of scholarship on King that I think you should all pick up and read and learn, teach, and talk about and consider the role that Dr. King has played in American politics and civil rights and in global politics today. Our panel today has been David Garrow. He is professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh and a former senior research fellow at Cambridge University. He's the author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which won the Pulitzer Prize for biography. Keith Miller, professor of English and affiliate faculty at the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Arizona State University. He is the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources. Jared Clements is a postdoctoral research associate at Princeton University. He is the author of From Freedom Now to Black Lives Matter, Retrieving King and Randolph to Theorize Contemporary White Anti-Racism. And Dewey Clayton, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. He's the author of Black Lives Matter and the Civil Rights Movement, a comparative analysis of two social movements. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.